Rain of Troy Hotline.
Alicia, Michael, what's going on?
We know you have takes. We have takes.
I'm actually surprised that your rant line, rave line, whatever, isn't completely full.
Why can't we just win a game?
Can I blame Michael Castillo for this?
Can I blame Bob Connolly for this?
Could I put on a zebra shirt and just go out there?
Scratch, claw, up against the wall.
Can't explain that what I'm feeling right now, guys.
Let's open up that rave line. Woohoo!
Oh, I can't believe USC is going to do the same thing again, year after year. Oh, no!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Rain of Troy Radio, episode 398, coming to you on Wednesday, January 13th. We're going to talk about the latest in USC football and so much more here on this episode. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Rain of Troy. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Rain of Troy. Be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Overcast, Google Play, Omni, wherever you can download a podcast, we are there. Our bonus episodes are on Patreon, patreon.com/Rain of Troy. Our email address is rainoftroy@fansided.com, and our phone number is 213-373-1USC.
Suck it, what's Burden Show.
I'm your host, Michael Castillo, joined along with my co-host, Alicia Deratola, here in the L.A. Rain of Troy. I don't know what I'm doing.
Hello, everybody. As opposed to the not L.A. Rain of Troy studio.
What am I doing? Joining me is my co-host in the Rain of Troy studio in Los Angeles, Alicia Deratola.
Hello, everybody.
It hasn't been that long since we recorded. I know we're a day late. We had technical issues.
We're a day late. We had technical issues and then had more technical issues. So at least we got those sorted out right as we were recording.
At least we hope.
We hope.
We hope we can get this through. We will see what happens, whether or not our audio will sound better than Ohio State's performance against Alabama on Monday night.
That is something that we strive for, to be better than Ohio State.
Yeah, this is true. What are your thoughts? Alabama winning the national championship. They're sixth in 12 years. Your opinion?
I think it's incredibly impressive what Nick Saban has done with Alabama, to the point where I can't think of a better college football head coach in the history of college football.
No.
In terms of just longevity, in terms of being able and willing to transition through so many different eras of college football, even micro eras of college football, Nick Saban has gone from vanilla offenses run by Greg McElroy to highly explosive offenses run by Greg McElroy's cousin, Mac Jones.
I think that's the most impressive thing for me, is that it's not just like, they're running the same thing over and over and over again, and they're beating you the same exact way, and just no one has an answer. No, he has completely changed his outlook in so many different ways. This is an entirely fundamentally different team now than it was then, because adapt or lose. That's basically what it is, and Nick Saban has basically said that himself.
And Nick Saban has adapted better than anybody. Every time people write off Alabama as this is the end of the dynasty, he turns around and figures it out. And it's pretty darn incredible what he's been able to achieve from the player development standpoint, from the recruiting standpoint, from the turnover of head coaches. Like, you're supposed to see a decline in the dynasties. Pete Carroll had this problem at USC. Brain drain, the turnover of head coaches. Nick Saban has solved that problem of assistant coaches. Yeah. But he's solved that problem, you know? He has become the master of rehabilitating failed head coaches. And do you know why that's genius? Because you don't become a head coach in college football unless you were really good at your job to begin with, unless you're Clay Helton. But that's an aside. He have rehabilitated Lane Kiffin, who was a brilliant offensive mind, and he's rehabilitated Steve Sarkisian, who was a brilliant offensive mind to start with. And he has an eye for what success looks like and what the demands of success are. It's incredible.
I have a take here. I'm curious your thoughts. I think that what Nick Saban is doing in Alabama, more impressive than what Wooden did at UCLA. And the reason
I agree.
The reasoning is because of all these things.
Yeah.
You know, what Wooden did at UCLA was incredible, never ever gonna be repeated. But he did that in an era before TV money, before scholarships were what they are now, before the modern game and before all these things, right? The what UCLA basketball was in the 1960s is way different what basketball is now, right? It's a completely different game. And so Nick Saban's ability to change on the fly, to adapt, to be able to do literally everything, beat teams with X's and O's, beat teams with physicality, beat teams with better players, beat teams that they lost to before and then come back and beat them again. Like a million different things he's done with completely different personnel, different types of personnel. Never in a million years did you think that Alabama would have an athletic quarterback until they did, until they got Jalen Hurts. And then you're like, well, how did they ever function before this?
Would you have ever guessed that the first Heisman wide receiver of this century would have played for Alabama?
No. I mean, and, you know, they had Julio Jones back at the beginning, but it's not like what Julio Jones was doing is comparable to Desmond Howard. Like,
yeah.
Julio Jones was a great wide receiver in Alabama, 100%. But great wide receivers don't win the Heisman Trophy unless you're far and away the best player on the field and having a million different ways to impact the game. And that's what Devontae Smith is.
And you're in an offense that allows you to...
Yeah.
Julio Jones in this offense could have also won the Heisman too, but like it takes this kind of offense to do it. And for Alabama to have now produced, you know, you expect the Alabama running backs to be in the Heisman conversation. To have the Alabama wide receiver win the Heisman is just, it shows that the change in mindset and the willingness to adapt that is the reason why Alabama continues to dominate college football.
Yeah, and you look at Mac Jones, compare him to the other quarterbacks, the other game managers, game manager type guys that Alabama has had. Your Jake Coker's, your McElroy's,
your McCarron.
Yeah, all those guys. Not only is Mac Jones, you know, probably not going to end up being as hyped for the NFL as Tua and all those guys, but he's able to get insane amount of production. And like, that's the crazy thing. It's like, literally everything has changed about this team.
But it's also, I mean, and this is to swing this back a little bit towards USC.
Yeah.
You watch Mac Jones in that offense and you think to yourself, like, this is what Matt Leinart was with USC. He has ages back there to throw. And when you give your quarterback, when you give a competent quarterback ages to throw like that and you put those weapons on the field for him, all he has to do is not make mistakes. And I think that's what Mac Jones has done really, really well. But like, that's, they're getting that kind of production out of a quarterback who all they're asking him to do is just not make mistakes.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, you know, you talk about the great teams of the college football, 1995 Nebraska, 2001 Miami, 2004 SC, 1972 SC, like, these great iconic teams, 1984 Penn State, whatever it is, in college football. And you and I had the discussion the other day that back at the early part of the Nick Saban dynasty in Alabama, I think that absolutely you could say 2004 USC would beat 2009 Alabama, would you know, probably beat 2011 Alabama. I don't think 2004 SC, they're not a favorite against 2020 Alabama. They're not.
This is the
and because you look at the, how do you beat Alabama? You have to have a dynamic quarterback and a dynamic offense and be able to beat them in a shootout.
Yeah.
The only way you can beat them. You look back at how all the losses Alabama has fared in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. It's been because of a dynamic quarterback that has beaten them in a shootout. SC has never had that.
Well, and this was the conversation that I was sort of having after watching that game. And I don't want it to turn into, you know, recency bias, and I don't want it to turn into hyperbole. But
not hyperbole.
Not hyperbole. But like, I was watching that team and thinking to myself, like, this is the first time I would sit here and think, I'm not certain Pete Carroll's best team would beat this team.
Right.
And that might be because this Alabama team didn't face the level of, this was a strange season.
The game has changed.
Maybe the competition wasn't, you know, Ohio State was dealing with some major personnel problems as far as guys that weren't available to them and all of that kind of stuff. So maybe I don't want to hype this up to a degree that, like, definitely this team would trounce the best USC team of the Pete Carroll era. But, like, I am not certain that I would put, you know, if Pete went against Saban at this stage with these teams, I'm not sure that he comes out on top. And that's the first time I've really been uncertain about that confidence that I have in the Pete Carroll USC sort of era. That's how impressive this team how impressive this dynasty has become to me.
Yeah, and I think it's sad that we didn't get to see what SC would be in, what is this, Nick Saban's, what, 14th year, 13th year at Alabama or whatever? We didn't get to see what year 13, 14, 15
years, 15 of Pete Carroll.
Years
yeah.
into Pete Carroll's reign at USC, what that would look like. Especially because the way he left, I think it's easy to assume that it was over, right? You know, you had had the brain drain. You had lost Ed Orgeron. You had lost Norm Chow. You had lost many guys.
Kiffin and Sark and every subsequent offensive coordinator and every subsequent defensive coordinator. Nick Holes.
Rocky Seto was like the defensive coordinator.
At the end. So
things had completely changed. And Pete Carroll had not shown a willingness to go outside the box and bring in fresh blood.
Well, but now also you have to wonder, the stories we have heard about that era of USC, it's not like they were investing a ton of money into the football program to begin with. So, you know, would Pete have fallen behind just in the arms? Would the natural USC falling behind in the arms race thing have happened regardless? Or would Pete have been the impetus for making sure that USC didn't fall behind as far in the arms race as they did?
I wouldn't have been surprised if SC would have just become the West Coast Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. In the sense that SC as an athletic department doesn't keep investing like what we know USC to be, right?
Yeah.
And then Pete Carroll has trouble, staffing, because this was a problem that we saw at USC. Obviously, he goes to the NFL, and we've seen him staff up a couple of times, and he's had success there. So maybe things completely change. Maybe if he comes back in 2010, everything completely changes. But I wouldn't be surprised that if SC was just going to be a 10-2, sometimes a one-loss team that gets in the playoff, but maybe not at the level of Alabama.
Right.
I don't know, but I wish that we could see it. Yeah. I wish we could have seen it out, at least. It would be fascinating to talk about. And none of this is to besmirch Pete Carroll and anything that he's accomplished. It's just, like, insane what Nick Saban has done. Nick Saban has done, like I said, I think it's more impressive than what John Wooden did at UCLA, which is the pinnacle of domination in American sports.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. Six titles over 12 years is more important, is a bigger accomplishment than the Islanders and the Oilers winning four in a row. Stanley Cups, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
and then you throw in the seventh title with LSU, and you're talking about a coach who has been successful at the college level, through so many different iterations of teams. He's just got it figured out. And I tweeted this while we were watching the game. Like, man, watching Alabama is jealousy inducing pain. Like, that's the only way I can describe it. Like, I sat back and thought to myself, like, is this what it was like to be a fan of like other teams watching USC play during the Carroll era, and when USC was always really great in out of conference games? Like, is that what
but
it was like watching those teams?
It,
yeah, but double the length of it, and just like the awe of how are they this good, and how can you know my team compete with something like that, I think is something that a lot of people around the country are asking themselves this week. Like, I know the Pac-12 is asking themselves, like, how does the Pac-12 get there? Because that mountain looks incredibly tall right now.
Well, the interesting thing is, I think that there's perspective here, because we talked about it before, there's only three teams in America that can compete at that level. Alabama, Clemson, and Ohio State. And what do you see? You saw Clemson get their ass kicked
Clemson's
by Alabama.
Not infallible.
I mean, by Ohio State.
Ohio State's
and
not
Ohio
infallible.
State get their ass kicked by Alabama. So, like, even within those three teams, there can be disparity from year to year because we've seen Clemson lay the wood on Alabama a couple years back. So there's even disparity there. But those three teams, a mile ahead of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can look at it and say it's insanely depressing that no one else can come close to them. But I also think you can look at it from the apathetic perspective of, well, no one else is coming close to them either.
Yeah.
Right? Like both of those perspectives kind of exist. One, you need it to fuel you. The other one, you need to look at it and say, I don't think there's any shame in being at that level that Notre Dame and Oklahoma are at.
Yeah.
But how do you close that gap? It's demoralizing to
think
about.
The demoralizing thing for USC is that
right.
USC should
is not
be,
even on that
USC
level.
Is not even at Notre Dame and Oklahoma.
Right.
And I think that USC, I think if we're talking about USC expectations, I think it's reasonable to sit back and say that USC should be in at least the Oklahoma, Notre Dame,
Georgia
tier where you aspire to being in that top tier, and if things go right one year, you get there. But like, I think it's unreasonable to turn around and say like, yeah, USC should be at Alabama's level. Like that happens, you know, rarely. Like you don't 99% of schools out there don't have that kind
of
firepower.
Did I mention it last week? Like even Ohio State, we put them in that group,
mm-hmm.
and how long did they go without a playoff win? Six years.
Yeah.
Right. And Urban Meyer, it's not like he was winning a national title
every year.
At Ohio State. There were many years he didn't make the playoff.
Well, and that's one of the things why, you know, there will be people on Twitter or even our listeners screaming right now, if USC hired Urban Meyer, they would get. Well, I don't even know that. Urban Meyer is not at Nick Saban's level. And, you know, I think USC cares about football less than Clemson. So, like, that's these are sort of part of the scenario there. But at the very least, USC should have a head coach, whether we're talking Urban Meyer or you know, some other up and comer who has this program competing with the Lincoln Rileys and the Brian Kellys of the world for that fourth playoff spot, for that coin flip of a playoff matchup. And USC isn't there. USC's not even at like Cincinnati's level right now, where they're getting left out of the playoff, and we have the conversation about it. Like USC is, you know, they're a step below that. USC is in the conversation for maybe winning the Pac-12 every year, which should not be the conversation that USC is necessarily having. USC should be you win the Pac-12 and you're making your argument for the playoff.
Yeah, I think SC should be in a shared dynasty with Oregon for the Pac-12.
Yeah.
Win the Pac-12 every other year with Oregon. You just go back and forth.
SC and Notre Dame should be having epic battles every year right
Absolutely,
now.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you should look at SC's schedule and be like, SC and Oregon, I gotta watch that.
Yeah.
That's gonna be a matchup of top 10 teams.
And
SC and Notre Dame, it's gonna be top five teams. Like,
yeah.
If those things existed,
like theoretically,
you could look at it completely different.
Theoretically,
too, right?
Theoretically, every year the USC Notre Dame game should be a game where you look at it goes, whoever wins this is in the playoff.
Yeah, and the same thing with the Oregon game.
Yeah,
it should be the same thing.
Yeah, but it's not, and that's an indictment of USC. That's an indictment of the Pac-12. That's an indictment of a lot of different things. But you know, I think you use the Alabama thing as motivation. Because eventually Nick Saban's going to retire. There is going to be maybe not a void that needs to be filled because Alabama will still be very good, but the domination will eventually end, and somebody's going to have to be there to compete for the free for all that's going to happen, the Game of Thrones, if you will, that's going to have the War of the Roses or whatever.
Wait, what's the what's the equivalent of Bran ended up as the king? The college spoiler alert.
Oregon State becoming national title winners.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Or no, Oregon State getting Nick Saban.
Yeah. Whatever. Something like that.
Anyways, I am in awe of you and me, I guess. Man, I don't know if we can get 20 minutes out of this podcast.
How many times?
We've got nothing to talk about. This is the skimpiest rundown we've had And yet, here we are, 19 minutes into this podcast, and we've yet to take a break. Which, before we get to that break, we want to talk to you about what we're doing here at Reign of Troy. In the off-season, we talked about it last week, Tuesdays we're going to drop new episodes, and here we are back-to-back weeks dropping a Wednesday episode. So clearly we have our things order technically and with everything else.
Okay, the playoff being on a Monday night, kind of this week was disordered as a result. So
yes, you know. But it's anyways. The point is we're coming up to you guys with a full episode every week, along with every other week over on Patreon, a bonus episode every Friday. That means this Friday is the first one we're doing a only Skinect episode based on the 2012 season. How much do you really remember?
The 2020 season?
2020 season.
I don't want to have to do 2012 season only Skinect. Not going to lie.
Sorry. I mean, we do have unfinished business this in is only true. Skinect. Yeah. 2020.
Yeah.
It's the TT, the
2020s. It's the double.
2012. Like they're
the double. Yeah. It's the repeat.
Yeah. Anyways. 2020. Over on Patreon. Patreon.com/RainOfTroys where you can get all of our bonus episodes. So look for that on Friday. But then next week, our full episode is going to be the Roddies episode. How excited are you?
It's an annual tradition.
It's an annual tradition that I don't think we've done the last 2 years.
I think we didn't do one last year because wanted that. But yeah, we're back.
We're back with the Roddies. Super excited about it. The Roddies are the Reign of Troy Awards. We're going to do those next week. If you are joining us over on Patreon, this is your opportunity to have a say. Alicia and I will be 2/3 of the voting pool to vote on the Roddies. The final third is going to be over on Patreon with our patrons getting to vote. We're going to put up ballot at some point in the next few days over on Patreon, so look for that. And then you'll be able to have your say on things like who wins the Reign of Troy MVP,
mm-hmm.
which will be more prestigious than the Nickelodeon MVP, I'll tell you that.
Yes. Well, we hope. I don't know.
One would hope.
Maybe Mitchell Trubisky will come out of nowhere and win our Reign of Troy MVP.
Oh, dear. Anyways, we got news to get to as well. We'll get to that in just a sec. All right, Alicia, USC has yet another player going into the College Football Hall of Fame. There's none other than the 2002 Heisman Trophy winner, Carson Palmer. Troy Polamalu was the last to be inducted 2 years ago in 2019. He was 44. Carson Palmer is 45. Which leads a question to who will be 46. I don't know. But congratulations to Carson Palmer. Fully deserved to get in there as a Heisman Trophy winner, All-American in 2002.
Yeah, the only reason he's waited this long is because he had a long NFL career that delays the induction just like Troy Polamalu. But yeah, the two linchpin players to that great I'm doing the same thing you did. The great 2002 team is now rightfully in the Hall of Fame, and I think it was a sort of a no brainer kind of decision. But it does raise the question. Like you did, who's number 46? I think we need to start having the Reggie Bush conversation.
Yes, absolutely. Reggie Bush should be in there.
I know that Mark Carrier is up for it every time the ballot goes around, and there's a couple of other guys that are up for it every time.
Matt Leinart's already in.
Leinart's in. Palmer's in. Palmer's in.
A couple of other Pete Carroll era guys I wouldn't be surprised to get in. Sam Baker. Yeah. Taylor Mays, guys who have accolades.
Ray Maluga,
yep.
Yeah.
Dwayne Jarrett, I think, would be an interesting one. Two-time All-American. He has a bunch of USC records.
Yeah.
Could see him getting in there. After that, I think that, I don't know. I mean, if you want to go back to that 2002 team, then Grudigood.
I don't know that Grudigood
get him in there.
I don't know the Grudiget is going to get to.
Why not?
There's some national award winning Trojans
He's
out there.
He's an All American.
Yeah, but All American is just the minimum.
Get him in there.
Which, by the way, I'll get on my soapbox right now, and I think the College Football Hall of Fame's criteria is all wrong. And I get that you want to have criteria to sort of make it easier on yourself, but also some of the requirements are just quite annoying because so much of it is political, as far as like who gets the All-American votes in any particular year. Case Keenum owns all of the NCAA records for passing, and he's ineligible for the Hall of Fame because he was never an All-American. I mean, my major soapbox has to do with coaching. In order to be eligible for the Hall of Fame, you have to have coached 10 years in college football. Pete Carroll's coached 9 years, so you're telling me that Pete Carroll is not a Hall of Famer? Like, that's some BS. So that's so my...
The way I look at it, I think that if you were a coach less than 10 years and you're even in the discussion, that should add weight to...
Right?
To what you're doing.
Right?
At the same point, I kind of like the criteria. I know that it sucks for Pete Carroll, and that if Pete Carroll wants to get in the College Football Hall of Fame, he's going to have to like spend a year at San Jose State after he retires or something like that.
Pete Carroll can come back for 1 year and go winless, 0-12, and he'd still make the Hall of Fame. So, right. Like, what even is the point of that?
Have a minimum games
requirement or something like that. You have to have coached 100 games.
But even if it was a minimum games, there's someone who would be screwed by it. You know what I mean?
But that's why I'm saying these arbitrary...
I'm kind of okay with having these things, though, because not that I care overwhelmingly, I really don't, but, like, the stupid discussions that happen in the NFL when people are like, yeah, but... Sterling Sharp, like, had this great career, and you know, you compare him to Calvin Johnson, or you compare him to Terrell Davis and all that. Like, at least you don't have those type of discussions because it's clear cut.
So you'd rather leave someone like Pete Carroll out of, let's assume that Pete Carroll stays in the NFL and retires and doesn't come back to college football.
Right.
You'd rather have Pete Carroll not be in the Hall of Fame than to occasionally have to have a discussion about someone stupid about whether or not they deserve to be in the Hall of Fame.
No, because I think that you change the criteria. I like that there is criteria.
I don't mind there being criteria, but the criteria is
10
dumb.
Years, I think, is a little too long because of what we know about college football coaches.
And yes.
College football coaches tend to go to the NFL at times if they're really successful,
yes.
Right? So I think that you could lower that to like 8 years and you would be fine.
Yeah.
And it's not just about Pete Carroll. I think just in general.
Yeah.
I get that you want your college football coaches to be tenured guys who are around forever. Your Bo Schembechlers, your Woody Hayeses. I get that and I agree. In theory, it'd be great if your Bob Stoopses were here that spent 20 years at a school. But
right.
But that's just not always realistic. The NFL does exist, unfortunately. So... You know, I lower it to 8 years. Change it to where, I mean, the All-American thing, I get it, but change it to where it's the All-American or an NCAA record.
Yeah, something, you know, like that. Or change the breadth of the All-American, because it's only the 5 selectors.
Right.
Acknowledge more selectors. I don't know. Whatever it is.
See, that's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Because then do you start, you know... you see this with USC. SC now acknowledges a lot of media things, collegefootballmadness.com,
yeah.
Whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And that will get you on the plaque. I think that I almost wonder if RaiderTroy.com had an All-American team, would it be acknowledged? I don't know. Probably not.
Maybe this is an idea.
But you know what I mean? Like you open a slippery slope, and then
right.
How do you decide? At least the 5 rigid ones, the AFCA, the FWAA, the AP, like the sporting, like those have always been set in stone that I'm okay with those being the 5.
Okay, so here's an argument. Here's just to get into the minutia of all of this. So in order to be on the ballot, you have to be submitted by the school.
So it's like an Emmy situation.
Yeah. So, like, why don't you just put a limitation on the number of candidates each school. I don't even know if there is a limit at this point. But like okay, for instance, if you take away the All-American requirement, your USC is still going to submit, you know, however many players they're going to submit each year. And like, chances are most of them are going to be All-Americans, but like USC could submit someone random or whatever, whoever could submit. Like, it wouldn't really hurt. You wouldn't have particularly less candidates if you said each school could only submit two and or three or whatever it is, and the school decides.
If you had a limit on the number that the school could go, I could see it. Because then you're like, well, there's nobody at Kent State that I want to put in. You know, you could just ignore those.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, but also it would allow you to have, you know, historic coaches or whatever, at least have the art. I'm not saying that, like, you know, Hal Mumme needs to be in the Hall of Fame, but
right.
if you wanted to submit his name and let the voters have that conversation, then have that conversation. I think there's better ways to do this than you have to have all been All-American or you have to have been a coach or whatever. I think to a certain degree, Hall of Famers, you just know who is. And like,
sure, yeah. And but the other thing is, what constitutes a Hall of Famer, too? Because you have the discussion of production versus impact.
Right.
And I think that's the interesting thing about college football is such an interesting game, especially from a coaching perspective. The coaches who have the most impact are not necessarily the ones that have the most production. Case in point, we were having this discussion the other day. Rich Rodriguez and Mike Leach. Hal Mumme, you mentioned too, right? June Jones. These are incredibly influential coaches that have, you know how many national titles they have between all of them? Zero. But they're incredible coaches who have had a lasting impact on the last 20 years plus of college football.
Right, but there's like a balance.
More so than anyone else.
No, there's a balance between those guys and, you know, the impact versus actual prestige and all that kind of stuff that I think you have to weigh. Personally, I wouldn't put Rich Rod or those guys in the hall because you do need to have a certain level of success.
Right.
And that your success broadens your impact.
To balance it out.
Right, but I think we should be having the debate. Have the debate.
Luckily for those guys, outside of Hal Mumme and June Jones, like, you can talk about, you know, their ability to get in there because they do meet most of the criteria.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's an interesting situation. Congratulations to Carson Palmer for getting in there for USC. I thought it was interesting that, you know, Palmer's able to get in there. And I put this on Twitter. I don't think anyone could have the career that Carson Palmer had today, where he comes up as a phenom, as a freshman. He takes SC to an 8-4 record, and you feel good about him as in the first year. Second year, you feel really good about him at the beginning of the year, and then all of a sudden he breaks his collarbone in a heartbreaking loss to Oregon. Nearly gets Wally Pipp, but doesn't. Wins back the job. 2000 and 2001 were disappointing seasons for him. A lot of hype. He had, you know, not really a good offensive line in front of him. The 2000 team was awful. 2001 got a little bit better, surely, but still, more to be desired from someone who was much ballyhooed coming out of high school. And then 2002, everything comes together. You got Norm Chow, you got Mike Williams, you got this offense that's loaded with veteran receivers like Kareem Kelly, and he's able to have a magnificent, iconic season. And win the Heisman Trophy. I don't think anyone in America would be given the luxury to fail, to come back from injury, to work things out, to wait for a coach that mends, that gels with what they need to do, like Carson Palmer. And I don't say this as an indictment on, oh, the game should go back to how it was back when I was a kid. Like, I'm not saying that in that kind of way, more so in just in awe of how the game has changed.
Well,
you look at JT Daniels, right?
Yeah.
JT Daniels never went to SC with the intentions of transferring.
Well, JT...
But the situation changed,
JT might be the closest down-the-line kind of candidate for the Carson Palmer career.
But he transferred.
Except this is the new era where you can't... You know, you're Joe Burrow, you transfer, and then you have your moment. You're Justin Fields, you transfer, and then you have your moment. You're JT Daniels, and you transfer, and he's probably going to have his moment. But it's just proof that, you know, don't write guys off too early. I mean, you see this in a lot of different places. Sometimes growing pains, particularly with quarterbacks, are necessary. And that's the beauty of when things seem to click for a quarterback or click for, you know, an athlete. Sometimes they have to work their way through, you know. Don't write off Ronald Jones after one week season. He can come around. You know, there's just little moments where guys theoretically get better.
Plus, this was a different era of college football where the recruiting camps weren't there for quarterbacks. I have to imagine that if Carson Palmer was around today, that he would have gotten either Wally Pipped. Or, you know, with the struggles in the year 2000, even with a bad team, I could absolutely see a situation where, you know, there's another up-and-coming five-star. And there wasn't another up-and-coming five-star on the roster for SC to make those changes.
Yeah.
But luckily, he was able to stick with it. He was able to, you know, get some rope and put together a hell of a season.
Historic one.
As a senior.
Yeah.
So, kudos to him. It was great watching him as a kid. Win that Heisman and now has a Hall of Famer. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool for number three. Other news, USC offensive coordinator, Graham Harrell, someone who I don't think is eligible for the Hall of Fame either. I don't think he was
He is not.
He was an All-American, even though he set a million records, which is unfortunate for him. He has been not picked for the Boise State head coaching job. The Broncos opted to go with Oregon defensive coordinator Andy Avalos, who played at Boise State, also had worked under Chris Peterson and Brian Harsin from 2012 to 2018. Bronco guy through and through. In hindsight, seems like an obvious choice to be the next head coach at Boise State, a school that kind of breeds great coaches. And it'll be interesting to see what he can do because everyone before him has gotten a big job. Harsin, Peterson.
There was someone else in there. I don't remember the
Dan Hawkins.
Yes, Hawkins. That's right.
And the list goes on.
But this is interesting because we talked about brain drain and the struggle that USC had with it in the early 2000s or in the mid to late 2000s. Oregon is dealing with some brain drain and Mario Cristobal is going to have to find the next DC. And Andy Avalos had done a really, really good job developing that defense and turning that secondary into something really...
Defense is why they're a great team.
Yeah, exactly. Well, their defense is why they keep beating USC because they have USC's number. I mean, Kayvon Thibodeau has a lot to do with it, but that defense in general has really flummoxed USC in the past 2 years. So that'll be something that USC will have to see face a new defensive coordinator next time around, and that Oregon, it'll be interesting. I mean, already we've seen rumors floating around on Twitter and on message boards about Oregon potentially looking at Todd Orlando because he has some history with Mario Cristobal and those guys. So it could get a little bit interesting up in here. I very, 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 very much doubt it. But Oregon is on the prowl for a new DC, so that'll have big ramifications for the Pac-12 and for USC as a result.
Absolutely. We'll see what comes of that. But for Graham Harrell, another opportunity that nothing comes out of it. But I think the interesting thing and probably the more realistic ones are going to be NFL OC jobs.
Yeah.
The NFL is, as of us recording right now, none of the seven jobs have been filled in the NFL. So they need to hire head coaches first, and those guys are going to hire offensive coordinators, and maybe there's somebody who looks at Graham, gives him an interview, and goes that way. Or there's going to be someone who gets hired as a trickle down.
I think
takes another job and opens up a new one.
Yeah, anything could happen. Weird stuff happens in the carousel. But I do think that I would expect Harrell to get another year at USC. I just don't think now is the time that he'd get that job, that he'd get the promotion. Coming off of this past season where there were questions about his ability to adjust to the defenses that he faced, and especially what happened against Oregon. So I think he is probably a year away from proving himself on that level to get the promotion. But you know, who knows? Crazy stuff happens.
I don't know that I would say that as a cut. I think we are critical of Graham Harrell. I think is the average person who didn't watch every single one of SC's games religiously as critical of Graham Harrell after this season? I don't think so. I think it's a completely different perspective. And if you were interested in him last year, I think you're still going to be interested in him this year.
See, I think my sense on this is that there are more people out there intrigued by him than interested. And I don't think he improved that standing from an intriguing coaching candidate to an actual gotten hire him coaching candidate.
Sure.
If that makes sense. That's my feel. Like, it's not.
Yeah, but we'll see how things go on with the NFL carousel and so much more. Talk about other awards. Elijah Barrett Tucker won the Morris Trophy, the first Trojan since Matt Khalil in 2011. And it was a big week for Talanoa Hufanga, who is the co-Polynesian Player of the Year, along with Zach Wilson from BYU. He's the first Trojan to win it ever. Juju had lost to Sefolofau in 2016. And then Hufanga is also a finalist for the Lott Impact Trophy, an award in which no Trojan has ever won either. So
two awards
that the Talanoa could break some barriers.
Well, I mean, two awards that it's shocking that USC hasn't had a Poly Player of the Year yet, because USC has had some really outstanding Polynesian players come through and be runners up or you know, finalists for that award. And then the Law Impact, same. USC has had finalists and runners up. And
have I told you my theory?
That they are like extra harsh on that they don't want to seem like it's.
Yeah, the Law Impact voters don't want to. This is completely.
It just doesn't want to be like a USC guy every year.
Like, well, we gotta look objective. We can't just give it to an SC guy every year. So let's make sure we're objective.
Well,
let's
I remember Adoree was a finalist, and I remember looking at it going like, okay, Adoree's definitely gonna win the Impact Award, but not the Thorpe. And then it turned out that he lost the Law Impact and then won the Thorpe, and it was just like, what even is happening? So, you know, one of those weird things. But Hufanga, we'll see about the Law Award. I think he's a great candidate for it, but good on him to get the Polynesian Player of the Year award, even though they code it for some reason. I mean, I don't know. It's their award. They get to do what they want with it.
It's a weird season.
Yeah.
I think that if there's a time to do it.
I mean, Zach Wilson's deserving. Like I'm not arguing that. It's just I didn't realize that was even on.
Yeah, he had a hell of a season too. So yeah. I get it. A year like this kind of makes sense. But yeah.
But also one thing on AVT before we move on. USC should be winning the Morris Trophy more often than once every 10 years. And at the very least, that's a good sign that AVT won it. But like that, you can't go another 10 years with your next Morris Trophy winner needs to be before,
especially
2031.
If you don't know what the Morris Trophy is, it is the Pac-12 lineman as voted on by the opposite lineman.
Yes. So that is an award that I think holds weight in my mind, and yeah, USC needs to do that more often.
Yes, indeed. We got some listener questions, so let's get to those and wrap this thing up. We'll be right back.
You've got mail.
All right, let's just start with a Slack message we got from Evan. Is Andrew Voorhees good? If so, how good?
Pro Football Focus really liked him this year. Unfortunately, what with the COVID and all of that kind of stuff, I wasn't able to do my rewatches as I normally would, where I'm getting sort of down deep into which offensive linemen are performing well and which aren't. I don't think he was bad. I think that just on first viewing, more often, the right side of the line was the one where the trouble was coming from. I don't know if that was that's sort of by design, because AVT was on the left and Voorhees is benefiting from sort of being on that side. But I think he was okay. I think he probably is okay. I don't know that I could say more than he's okay.
I look at offensive linemen.
Well, it's a unit, right? So
as a unit, but I look at players and put them into three tiers. And this is because I don't watch them on every play. I'm not an offensive line guru that knows all the ins and outs and all those kind of things. So I view offensive linemen as as either a liability, not a liability, or great. Like, those are the three categories. And not a liability could mean that they're very good. It could just be that we just don't hear from them as much. And it's kind of like a cornerback. A cornerback who's not a liability could be really, really, really good. And unfortunately, sometimes you're just not able to tell because you just don't hear the name all the time. It's like a long snapper. Alicia, you and I had a conversation about Damon Johnson. and you're like, he's an elite long snapper. I'm like, how do you know? Like, you never hear his name, which means obviously he's good at what he does. But is he the best in the world at what he does? Like, I don't know. Like, there's like 20 long snappers in the country who have a perfect record. How do you distinguish between all the ones that have a perfect record?
Well, I certainly can't distinguish, but I know that the people who know things about long snappers say that Damon Johnson is a very, very good long snapper. That's
sure.
All I can say.
Cool.
but I think you're right in that offensive linemen are either liabilities or really good, or they're somewhere in that murky in between. And I would put Voorhees this past season was probably somewhere in that murky in between.
He was definitely not a liability.
He was not the ones whose name I was having to call out every time I watched the game.
Right.
But he's not AVT. He's not the guy who will shut down the pass rusher or be the guy that's leading the way on every blocking play, every run block or whatever. So, you know, medium. He is medium. Let's go with it.
He's a veteran presence, and I think that certainly helps. And not being a liability is the first main step in being a great player on the offensive line. Let's go to an email we got from Troy Trojan. Graham Harrell, he comes off as smug and arrogant. He's no offensive mastermind as he runs a gimmicky, simplistic offense. He has managed to make two position groups irrelevant on offense, tight ends and running backs. His offensive line is in crisis mode. His quarterback has regressed. We never hear about him being a top recruiter, yet he gets interviews after head coaching interviews every year. What am I missing here? Honestly, if I was looking for a head coach, I can think of about 50 candidates before he would even come on my radar. Please, sell me what I'm missing.
All right, thanks for the email, Troy Trojan. Good name. So here's my argument for Graham Harrell. He is a considered an up and coming coach. He's not the finished article, but he is from this sort of air raid tree of sort of respected minds in that air raid offense. He has recruited decently, at least, because he's brought in Miller Moss. He had Jake Garcia for a time before, you know, that got complicated more because they went after Miller Moss. He was able to close the deal on Jackson Dart. So I don't think recruiting quarterbacks has been an issue for Graham Harrell at this point. We know that Graham Harrell was able to talk Jude Wolf and Ethan Ray into coming to USC or to sort of sticking it out, even though they're tight ends. And they've gotten Michael Trigg and those guys to be convinced to come to USC as tight ends. So I don't think recruiting has been a negative factor for him. I do think that you can have criticisms about the offense and the simplicity of it. It's not the kind of simplicity that has been beautiful yet, because it has been a difficulty on the run side of things. To say the least. Defenses have been able to get the better of the passing side of it by going into the zone, and USC doesn't have a...
Can I just say, I think that is completely overstated.
That
was a problem early on in 2019, but when SC was at their absolute best under Graham Harrell, which was November 2019, everyone knew what the book was. Every single defense knew how to defend, and Keaton Slovis was still throwing for 400 yards a game.
Right. Yeah, no, but I think that defensive coordinators...
Iowa knew how to defend him,
yeah.
And Keaton Slovis was shredding Iowa for the time he was healthy in that game.
What I'll say is I think defenses have been able to limit USC's offense to a degree that I think you shouldn't be at. But again, remember, this past season, USC's scoring average went up again under Graham Harrell. So I don't think the offense is the finished article yet. I don't think it's perfect. I think there are some serious complaints you can have about the run schemes, about the run game, about the way that it's used, all of that kind of stuff. As I've said before, I would love to see tight ends involved more often. There were some plays in the Alabama-Ohio State game where the tight ends were drool-worthy, but I don't think that tight ends... I think that having tight ends be active in your offense is not the end-all and be-all. I think when you have wide receivers like USC has, those are the end-all and be-all for a reason. But like I said, like Graham Harrell, I think... And again, you got on this earlier, Michael. Like, we watch every game and we dissect it very, very closely. I think that if you're not watching every game, you come away looking at Graham Harrell's offense and say, wow, look at how explosive and how dangerous that offense is.
I agree with the sentiment of, like, you can come up with 50 other candidates before Graham Harrell, but I think you gotta look at it from the perspective of every offensive coordinator is always fond about every offensive coordinator from a productive offense, because every single AD wants to go out and hire the next Lincoln Riley, the next Sean McVay, the next this, the next that.
Well, Cliff Kingsbury was a failed college head coach, right? And he got an NFL head coaching job. So, like, stuff happens.
Exactly. I think that you look at what college football is going in during this explosion of offense, and so much of it is pass related. And it's lending so much to air raid concepts and everything. I mean, look at Alabama and look at their vertical passing game. It's not an air raid, but it's certainly there's a lot of parts of it that make a lot of sense and compared to what USC is doing in different ways. Obviously, it's not the same offense. But, right, like, the vertical passing game is a thing. The air raid in of itself, like, can change from being vertical or actually being a bunch of short stuff, and SC kind of goes back and forth between those two. But there's definitely ways to fault Graham Harrell's offense 100%. I think there's an identity crisis, and this is why, you know, the idea that he comes off as smug and arrogant, I don't necessarily buy. I think he comes up as standing up for his offense. The problem is, and the identity crisis that USC has, I fully support Graham Harrell and Clay Helton standing up and saying, we're not going to go into go under center on fourth down because that's not who we are. We run an offense that is this, this, and this. Yes, I agree with you. Stand up for what your offense is. Stand up for what you believe in. Stand up for what your scheme is. But I think we all know this offense would be way better if they ran the ball less. And yet they don't. And I think that that's an identity crisis that I don't know if that comes from this is SC where there's just too many talented running backs on the roster, or this is SC where this is tailback you have to, and there's this myopic view of this is SC, you have to run the ball X amount of times a game in order to satisfy the football gods. I don't know what it is, but you look back again and when SC was at their best, under Graham Harrell, and it's when they knew what they were. It's when all the running backs were hurt, with the exception of Keenan Christen last November. The book was out on USC's offense. Defenses knew how to defend them. Everyone knew that they didn't have any running backs outside of a true freshman running back in Christen. Everyone knew that, and they still put up a million points, a million yards for a 4 or 5 game stretch and looked great. And yet, you come into this season and they want to run the ball X amount of yards and all these things, and it's like you've gone away from what your identity is for no reason. And so I think there's absolutely a million things to criticize about Graham Harrell, but to go back to the question is, it's always people look at what could be, and people imagine what things could be. If Graham Harrell is what he was in November, then yeah, people are going to be intrigued about what he could do with their talent on their roster and whatnot. So yeah,
and molded,
I get it.
And molded in the right way. But I think the biggest problem that USC has right now is the half measure. And
right. It's a ton of half measure.
And I will put that squarely on Clay Helton. Now, Graham Harrell, again, I don't want to excuse him because it is his job to get better and to adjust and to
learn
on the fly.
Right, and he's got to get better in those areas.
He does
sure.
need to figure himself out. But right now, USC would be better off if they went all in on the air raid and stopped trying to act like they were anything but. And if they did air raidy run plays where they're not just trying, you know, if the idea was to catch the defense off guard, like the way the Washington State used to do it with their running backs who would be, you know, would get chunk yards because you weren't expecting them. That's a better strategy for running the ball if you want. And you do need to be able to run the ball. The problem is that USC wants to be an air raid team while also beating their chest and saying, well, we can run the ball. Like, you can't, though. So either change the scheme to the degree that you can run the ball, change the way you practice, change all of that kind of stuff, or stop talking about it. Right now, USC wants to have their cake and eat it too, and it's and the in-between is not working.
Yeah. Final thought about the tight ends thing. And maybe I'm just clinging to this and this is just overblown. I seriously think that if Drake London wasn't on the roster, the tight ends would be used differently. Maybe I'm naive.
I don't know.
Well,
I think it's hard to...
We'd have to see when he doesn't have Drake London. I don't know that he's going to get an opportunity to not have Drake London
on this roster. Speaking of half measures, the tight ends are the biggest victims of the whole half measure thing because the tight ends are used as though they were sort of jumbo tight ends, and none of them are. So then when they're asked to be these blocking specialists that none of them are, by the way, Eric Cromanhook is the closest thing you have to it, and he's... you know, put up against guys that he can't possibly block, you're setting them all up for failure. I wish that USC would stop setting certain position groups up for failure. And I agree with Trojan here in that the tight ends and the running backs, I don't know that I'd call them irrelevant, but I think those position groups are being set up for failure in a way that that they shouldn't be.
Yeah. It's good email we got from Brian. Now that Texas has hired Sark, do you think Alabama would hire Clay Helton to be their offensive coordinator? Just hoping. Right.
It's a rhetorical question, but I do want to put out there that this is why when we talk about the hiring of Clay Helton at USC, why I think the mistake goes back all the way to the beginning, because if Clay Helton is ultimately, let go from USC, he will not end up on Steve Sarkisian. I mean, he will not end up on Nick Saban's staff as an offensive coordinator. And that's because he was never an elite offensive coordinator to begin with. And
I mean,
there's
Butch
a lot of
Jones
root problems.
Is on that payroll.
I mean, I think Butch Jones was probably elite for longer than Clay Helton ever was. Not as a head coach, but.
Well, maybe more sought after coming out of Cincinnati, sure, because
you know,
Clay Helton never had that opportunity.
You know what you do? You bring in, and I say this with all due respect, you bring in Clay Helton to be your tight ends coach and be your rah-rah fatherly figure on your staff. But I don't think you bring in Clay Helton to design your offense the way that you bring in Steve Sarkisian or Lane Kiffin to do it.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. We did get a Slack message from SJ in Santa Barbara. Would you hire Tom Herman as SC's offensive coordinator? You know Saban would. I guess this is the case of if Graham Harrell wasn't there.
Let's say Graham Harrell gets a job somewhere else. I actually don't think it would be the worst idea ever, except for the whole, like, it would never, ever, 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 ever happen. I don't think.
Like the whole, like, are you saying that? That Clay wouldn't bring in a bigger fish underneath him?
No, I think if you're Tom Herman, you sit back and enjoy your millions while not having to go.
If you're Tom Herman, you absolutely go for that Alabama job.
Yeah, you go for the absolutely you go for the Alabama job. I don't think you go for the USC job unless you think to yourself, "Well, this is my rehabilitation, and when Clay gets the axe, I get to be the White Knight and take over or whatever." I don't know. I think there's a lot of things going in there, but. Tom Herman is the profile of offensive coordinator that I would be looking for. Tom Herman is what I'm talking about when I say that Tom Herman is what Clay Helton was not.
Right. Offensive guru that got an opportunity.
Overpromoted to head coach and it didn't work out for him. But that's the guy that Saban rehabilitates.
I'm not convinced that Tom Herman's not a good head coach. I wouldn't be surprised if just Texas is just not a place to. If Texas just has so many toxic issues, which leads to Sark. I, I'm super pumped for Sark to get that job.
But Texas is too high of. I wouldn't Texas have wanted him to go to risk. Texas. Yeah.
Texas is high risk, high reward. Obviously, if you can get everything to go, but I fully expect that Sark's tenure at Texas is going to look a lot like Tom Herman's.
I agree.
I think that his offense might be more inclined to be a little bit more forward thinking, just because we've seen that Tom Herman's offense is very good. I don't think it's as good as Sark's offense at this point in time, but I don't know. I think that the thing is still there. It's gonna at best. They're 1B behind Oklahoma.
Okay, but here's the thing, and this is the problem with all of these evaluations. Sark's offense is great when he has an offensive line, and he has that at Alabama, and he didn't have that in Atlanta, and he didn't have that at USC for the most part. Like, Sark's offense needs that piece to come together, and that is the thing that I will be curious of. What Sark has picked up from Saban as far as developing the whole team to be able to thrive the way that they do at Alabama.